Correctional Services Canada has started preliminary work on the expansion of two federal prisons, Collins Bay Institution in Kingston, Ontario, and Stony Mountain Institution north of Winnipeg. At Stony Mountain, a new 96-bed maximum security unit will be built with an expected construction cost of $20 million. The John Howard Society of Manitoba works with offenders and ex-offenders before, during, and after their incarceration. John Hutton is the Executive Director of the John Howard Society of Manitoba, and he joins me now in the studio. Welcome, John.
Good afternoon.
What information have you been provided about the plan changes at Stony Mountain?
Formally, no information at all. Anecdotally, I've heard from people that work at the institution and my staff who are out there on a regular basis, I've been able to piece some things together, but there's been no sort of formal briefing, and I'm not even sure if I've seen a press release from the government on the expansion.
Are they not wanting to let the public know that they're expanding Stony Mountain? Would there be a reason it's not being made public?
It's hard to say. Frankly, this government doesn't seem to be terribly interested in getting input from the public, getting input from anyone that is outside of their particular ideological view. And it could just be that they simply don't see the need to publicize what they're doing because they're not interested in the response. And it could be that's the best case scenario. The worst case is that they are trying to slip in something without people knowing. And that's what we would call a super prison, where this is actually just the first step. They would add a maximum security wing at Stony Mountain and then take the Rockwood Institution, which is a minimum security, and roll it into the Stony Mountain prison as well. And then you'd have one prison housing all classifications of inmates. Sounds efficient. Sounds like it might make some sense, but it would actually create a lot of challenges, and mixing the populations is likely to add more stress, more violence, and more challenges for the staff and for the inmates themselves. And it's likely to also cause a very severe deterioration in the level of care and safety for the inmates at those institutions.
So if you add in maximum security units, does then that puts more restrictions on the minimum security population?
It puts more restrictions on both the medium and the minimum security. It might create a wall around the minimum where one doesn't exist right now, which would really change the nature of minimum security. And I'll come back to that in a moment. But I have toured the there is a one of the units at Stony Mountain right now is a segregation or maximum security unit right now, and it's probably used more for segregation, but it can be used for housing inmates that are in maximum security that might be traveling back to Winnipeg, say, for a court case or an appeal. And the guards are all wearing stab-proof vests, and it's quite a different level of tension and alertness, and of course that sort of would spill out into the rest of the institution and would create sort of a greater sense of tension within the medium security institution as well, which isn't a good thing.
How does Rockwood differ from Stony Mountain in terms of the atmosphere and the environment for the prisoners there?
I think Rockwood is a minimum security institution, and it's very important. If you think about it, most people who are incarcerated are being incarcerated because they've made very bad choices. And when presented with a certain situation, they've made the bad choice rather than the good choice. So what do we do to punish people who've essentially made very bad choices? We put them in a prison and take away their ability or severely curtail their ability to make choices at all. And if you're being held in medium security, you're probably locked up for 18 hours a day. You have very you don't choose when to go to bed, when to get up, what to wear, what to eat, who to socialize with, and you lead a very structured, extremely structured and regimented existence. Some people are released from medium security right back into the community. And so we say, okay, we've put you in a place where you don't have to make a lot of choices. Now we're going to put you back into the community. Good luck and make good choices this time. And it's almost setting people up to fail. Within a minimum security environment, the inmates are still incarcerated. They are still in a prison, but they have much more opportunity to exercise choice for themselves. And they are given a little budget, and they buy their own food from a canteen. They cook it themselves. They live in houses with other inmates, and they have to deal with conflict together. They have more choice over their programming and other things in it, and it prepares them much more to return to the community. But one of the biggest aspects of the minimum security is there's no wall around it. If you want to escape from Rockwood, it's not very difficult. You just start walking. When inmates are transferred into to Rockwood, they're agreeing to a number of rules, and one of the things they're agreeing to is that they're taking responsibility for themselves, and they're agreeing not to try to escape. And they know if they do and they're caught, they would be put back in medium or perhaps even maximum security, and so there are some consequences, but they're exercising that responsibility. They're entering into an agreement to essentially look after themselves and to get along in a group setting. And that's much more, actually a very important part of the rehabilitation and them preparing themselves to move back into the community and successfully be able to stay in the community. Putting a minimum security institution into a maximum would take away that whole aspect, that element of what makes the minimum security so successful at rehabilitating prisoners. Plus, it's going to increase the costs as well, and I'm not sure what that means, because you the least amount of money is to have a minimum security prison, the most is a maximum, and if you add a maximum to a medium and then bring in a minimum and create this super prison, you're probably going to end up with higher costs because you're going to have a greater level of security for everyone, even those that aren't needing it or aren't getting it right now.
The federal government isn't alone in wanting more prison beds in Manitoba. From what I've heard, both the provincial government as well as the union that represents workers in prison are also talking about the problems with overcrowding and the need. But a lot of the need is also coming from the federal government's tough-on-crime mm-hmm. policies, some which have yet to be implemented. Is there any evidence that these policies will reduce crime or make Manitoba safer?
Absolutely not. The government hasn't presented any evidence, nor is there any evidence to show that incarcerating people for longer periods of time, imposing minimum sentences, making it harder for people to get a parole, to get their parole. These are the three basic components of the so-called tough on crime, or what I refer to as a punitive approach to crime, have any effect on the on crime rates at all. The government hasn't produced any evidence to show it'll make a difference, and in the United States, where this has been going on for 30 years, not only have they abandoned this particular approach as being totally unworkable and hugely expensive, there was no benefit. If you think in terms of a business, imagine a business person being asked to increase spending by 600% in order to get a return of 20%. Well, that's what happened in the United States when they started incarcerating people at such a higher level. They are now spending over a 600% increase in the cost of incarceration, while they saw that the crime rates dropped around 20%. And ironically, the crime rates also dropped in Canada at the same amount during the same time, where at a time when we weren't trying this tough on crime approach, which suggests that even that 20% improvement was not the result of the policies, but was the result of something else, most likely the aging of the population. As our population on average gets older, crime rates are going to fall for a couple of reasons. As you get older, you have less tolerance for being locked up. People don't want to die in prison. They don't want to spend the rest of their lives literally in prison. And crime is associated with younger people because it's often around impulse and poor judgment and making bad judgments without a lot of thought. And that's characteristic of a younger population. I realize I'm speaking to students here, so I'll be careful with that. But unfortunately, we are seeing the population in the federal prisons getting younger and younger, and it's not uncommon to encounter 18 or 19-year-olds doing federal time, and that's unfortunate. But at any rate, there is no evidence to show that a tougher approach to responding to crime has any effect on crime rates. The crime has already occurred. The victim has already been hurt. Whatever happens to the individual after that point isn't going to make a difference. And if you don't address the causes of crime, but simply lock people up for longer, which is what they did in the United States and Harper's proposing to do in Canada, what you're doing is, in a sense, you're just creating vacancies. You take one person off the street who's been dealing drugs, someone else deals drugs in their place. You take that person off, you've created another vacancy. And let's be honest, most of the people in jail in the United States are there for drug offenses. And Harper said he wants mandatory minimums for drug sentences here in Canada, which is going to see a very large spike in the number of people in Canada who are serving time for drug offenses. And taking away a drug dealer without dealing with some of the issues that create the market for the drugs, the demand, the need, all you're doing is creating a vacancy, and that's what they've done in the United States.
What would you like to see the government spend money on instead of building more prisons or enforcing more criminal laws?
I think the first step would be to just, I would like to see the government adopt an evidence-based approach to their policy. If I, as the executive director of a not-for-profit organization, apply to the government for a grant or for money for a particular program, I have to present an argument based on evidence to show that what we propose to do has a chance of working. All not-for-profits have to do that. And yet the government themselves doesn't impose that discipline when they're making decisions. So the first step would be for the government to commit itself to not making decisions that aren't evidence-based. So when they go to pass any piece of legislation, they come up with evidence and say, this is what we're trying to do, this is why we think we can do it, and then they build in a review process. When I get funding from a funder, I generally have to show that down the road it is having the desired effect. And that's the second thing that the government isn't doing. If they're going to put all this money into more prisons, where's the review period? Where are they going to say, okay, and in 5 years' time, we'll check to see if this is actually having any effect? So evidence-based approaches, built-in reviews, and more specifically, to move away from a punitive approach where you're just trying to punish someone further because it's politically popular, and it is. I get shouted down when I go on to CJOB. I know how popular it is. The problem is it doesn't work. What works are preventative approaches, increasing more money for drug treatment programs, increasing more money for youth programs. Here in Winnipeg, the government finally, after about 6 months, announced that it would at some point in the future restore funding to 5 really effective programs that were working with at-risk youth that were already involved in street gangs. Now, because the government had no plan in place, at least one of those programs I'm aware of personally had to close its doors, lay off staff, and tell their participants that they couldn't serve them anymore. The government stalled, and only probably because of the election, and they didn't want to get embarrassed in the middle of a campaign, belatedly made a commitment to continue this funding, much less, by the way, than what they're putting into Youth for Christ. So there needs to be much more interest in preventative types of programming and in not punitive approaches. And efforts to programs as well that work with ex-offenders and increase employment opportunities and provide housing and other opportunities for people to come out of jail or prison and move back into the community and have their needs met, and have their needs met in a way that doesn't involve crime. And it seems like a simple thing, but probably having employment is one of the number one factors in helping ex-offenders go straight and stay straight. And secondly, it's the responsibility of being a parent that I often see. So some supports for the offenders as they're coming back into the community, because this is a group that is has the potential to commit a crime again and bring recidivism down. But you don't do it by locking them up longer. You do it by using a more proactive approach and, in fact, giving people responsibility when it's safe to do so, more quickly, and giving them additional responsibility, even if they're still incarcerated, so that they can start learning how to make good decisions even before they're released.
Well, thank you for joining me and talking about this today.
No problem. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
I've been speaking with John Hutton, Executive Director of the John Howard Society of Manitoba. You can find more information on their programs and services at their website, which is johnhoward.mb.ca. And on our website, we will be providing a link to this conversation, and that will be available at mudandwater.org.